So it's my turn for reading, and I tried to return to Ajahn Chah, but I wanted to read from this book, Being Dhamma, which is translated by Paul Brider. And Paul was somebody who was very close to Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah had a real soft spot for him, which is sometimes dangerous. He couldn't get away with much. So, he did this. I don't know. That was the early years of Bhaya Gir. It's probably 10 years ago or so. Yeah, closer to 15. And 2001.
It was about the time we did the thing down
for a while. Yeah. And he was, he went back, and his Thai reading is not very good, but very good command of the language and memory, and both the Thai and the Lao. So he went back to a lot of the old recordings and translated directly from the recordings. So
it's listening to him while he was delivering the mail.
Huh? Yes, that's true. He was delivering mail in Santa Rosa, and be listening to Ajahn Chah all the time and going back and working on the book. Okay, so this, and I started looking at this, and I was sort of like, oh, this is a good one, and this is a good one. So I ended up deciding to read the talk called Kundanya Knows. We are practitioners of Dhamma. All Dhammas are nature, existing as it is. Nature is exclusively and completely Dhamma. Those things are not yet clear to us because we haven't come to know the way to practice, so we need to rely on the instructions and training of a qualified teacher. Nature also teaches us. Things such as trees are born from their causes and grow accordingly. This is nature showing us something, but we are not yet able to see that the trees are teaching us. All the way from the birth to growing, blossoming, and giving fruit, we merely see them as supplying fruit for us to eat. We don't see them as something for us to turn inward and reflect upon. We should know that Dhamma is the tree teaching us, but we don't realize that yet. When the tree gives fruit, we gather and eat it indifferently without any real investigation or consideration. The sweet and sour tastes of fruit are their nature. These characteristics are Dhamma, and the fruits are teaching us something, but we don't understand that. When the leaves of the tree wither and die, they fall. We only see it as leaves falling, and we tread on them or sweep them up without any investigation. We don't realize this is Dhamma, teaching something for us to hear. The leaves of the tree fall, then the new buds appear. We see this cycle, but don't really think much about it, so we don't learn anything of significance from it. If we were to turn inward, we would see that our own birth and death are not so very different from that of trees. This body comes into being as a result of various causes and depends on the four elements for its existence. It grows and comes to fruition of different kinds, just like a tree. And the falling leaves and new buds are no different from the lives of people. Take a look at this. We are constantly growing, and conditions are constantly changing. Like the trees, just as trees are, so are we. All humans are born in the beginning, change in the middle, their physical constituents changing into something different from what they were, and pass away in the end. The natural phenomena of trees, vines, and shrubs are continuously and unceasingly in a state of flux. And if we turn this inward, we will understand birth, aging, and death within ourselves, just as we see them externally. When you understand Dhamma from listening to the words of a qualified teacher, it truly pricks your heart. Outer and inner are the same. Sankhara, conditioned phenomena with or without consciousness occupying them, are the same. not different at all. If we understand this, then seeing the way trees are, we will see the nature of our aggregates of body, feelings, perceptions, thoughts, and consciousness. With this kind of understanding, we are called people who understand Dhamma. Being people who understand Dhamma, we will strive to see Dhamma everywhere and in all things, to see the characteristics of our five khandhas, that they are continually in a state of flux, moving, changing, and transforming without any let-up. Whether we are standing, sitting, walking, or lying down, we employ mindfulness to guard and watch at all times. Seeing external objects, it is the same as seeing internal phenomena. Seeing internal phenomena is the same as seeing external phenomena, because they are of the same nature. When it is like this, we are hearing the teaching of the Buddha. With this understanding, it is said that the Buddha nature, meaning the one who knows, is awakened. There is knowledge of internal and external phenomena and the ability to explain the facets of Dhamma in various ways according to what we have seen. We are constantly hearing the teachings of the Buddha, whether we are walking, standing, sitting, or lying down. And whenever we are seeing forms, hearing sounds, savoring tastes, and so on, it is exactly as if the Buddha were teaching us, because the Buddha is just this one who knows, dwelling within our hearts. Knowing and seeing and investigating the Dhamma like this, the Buddha is present. It is not that the Buddha entered final Nibbana long ago and cannot teach us now. The Buddha nature, which means our own minds, when clear knowledge has arisen, will lead us to investigate and know all Dhammas. This knowing of the Dhamma is the Buddha itself, Buddha himself. If we establish Buddha in our hearts, having this awareness and sensitivity, then as we go on investigating, we'll see all things as no different from ourselves. Living creatures, plants and animals, poor people and those in difficulty, rich people, dark or light-skinned people, are no different from us, because all of them are of the same characteristics. With this understanding, wherever we stay, we will be content and at ease. The Buddha will be there, constantly instructing and assisting us. Without this understanding, we will always have the desire to hear teachings. We will want to seek out different teachers, one after the next, and will always be asking when we can get still another teaching, all the while not yet understanding Dhamma. The Buddha said that becoming enlightened to the Dhamma is a matter of understanding nature, things as they are. If we don't know nature, when we meet with situations, we are thrown into turmoil and are always in a state of struggle. We are delighted with things and get lost, being fooled by them. We are upset by things and fooled by them. We are deluded in nature, fooled by nature, and are at the mercy of our moods and emotions. Being deluded about nature like this means that we do not understand Dhamma. So the Enlightened One explained about what is natural. This nature is not something mysterious. In nature, things appear, change, and come to an end. It is the same for the material objects created by people. The pots and dishes we use, for example, are also created by causes and conditions, which are the conceptions and intentions of human beings. They are used for a while, they become worn, and finally break and fall apart. That is ordinary for them. Trees, plants, and mountains, as well as animals and humans, are the same, coming into existence, changing and deteriorating, and in the end, breaking up and disappearing. So in the ascetic Anya Kondanya listened to the words of the Buddha as the first disciple, the realization he had was nothing very complicated. He understood that whatever comes into existence will naturally undergo change and finally cease to be. That is the nature of things. Previously, Kondanya had not realized this. He had not considered this fact and seen it clearly. Or perhaps he had thought about it, but had not contemplated it thoroughly. Thus, he had not let go. He had still clung to the five aggregates. But when he sat before the Buddha and listened to the teachings for the first time with clear mindfulness, the Buddha nature awakened in him, and he was able to receive authentic transmission of one level of Dhamma, which was that all sankhara are uncertain. All things that are born will undergo transformation and finally cease to be. That is what is ordinary and natural for them. The understanding that arose in Kondanya upon hearing the words of the Buddha was different from anything he had experienced before. He realized the mind as it actually is. So it is said, the Buddha arose within him. Then the Lord Buddha proclaimed that Kundanya had attained the eye of wisdom and seen Dhamma. What did it mean that he had seen the Dhamma? He had attained knowledge and vision that all things arise in the beginning, change in the middle, and pass away in the end. All things means all phenomena of body and mind, and these characteristics apply to all of them without exception. When this understanding clearly penetrated the heart of Anya Kundanya at the moment when he sat before the Buddha, it became the cause that enabled him to remove all clinging to sankhara from his mind. The view that holds the body to be one's own and to be oneself, and leads one to believe in a self, was clearly seen and uprooted. Once belief in a self was uprooted, the mind of skeptical doubt also came to an end. There was no more bewilderment about phenomena, his knowledge of things having been transformed. As for superstitious attachment to conventions, rites, and rituals, his practice had become correct and straight, so there was no more doubt or hesitation, no more groping or fumbling about cause and effect. If the body were to become sick or experience any other changes, he would not have any hazy notions about it. The ending of doubt had removed attachment and clinging. If there is still attachment, we will still be groping after the meaning of things that happen to the body, and this groping is superstition. But when belief in an attachment to the body as ourselves or our own is removed, there is no longer uncertainty or superstitious notions. So when the Supreme Teacher expounded Dhamma, Anya Kundanya opened the eye of Dhamma. He now saw clearly. His view of things was reversed. When this seeing became clear and focused, his clinging was uprooted. When clinging was done away with, the one who knows had truly arisen. Before there had been knowledge, but he had not been able to remove clinging. This meant that he knew the Dhamma, but did not see Dhamma. Or we could say that he saw Dhamma, but had not become one with Dhamma, because he did not know the actual condition of things. Thus, the Supreme Teacher proclaimed, Kundanya knows. Normally, we are deluded and confused about nature, for example, our bodies. They are composed of earth, water, fire, and air. That is one aspect of nature, material phenomena that can be seen with the eyes. This form of nature is nourished by food, grows and changes, and eventually disappears. Internally, there is the one who is in charge of the body, the consciousness or faculty of knowing. When this knowing occurs through the eye, it is called eye consciousness, or the sense of sight. When it occurs through the ear, it is called the sense of hearing. When it occurs through the nose, it is called the sense of smell, and so on for the tongue, body, and mind. There is one knowing, but we call it different things when it occurs through different senses. Six types of consciousness are mentioned in the teachings, but it is only a convention to specify when we are knowing at different points of sense contact, through the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, or the mind. In truth, there are not six. It is one faculty of knowing that is capable of awareness at these six points. And this one mind, this one who knows, has the potential to know things as they really are, which is knowing nature. Whenever this one who knows is still obscured, its knowing is only the knowing of delusion, knowing in wrong ways, having a wrong understanding of things. It is just the same fundamental awareness, nothing other. Knowing and seeing correctly, or knowing and seeing wrongly, are functions of this one faculty of awareness. Thus, when we talk about wrong view and right view, we are not talking about two separate things, two separate minds or places of origin. When delusion is present, it hides the truth and obscures the mind, and our awareness is mistaken. When our awareness is wrong, our view is wrong. Following that, actions will be wrong, livelihood will be wrong, all will be wrong, and this all begins with wrong understanding. The factors of the path arise in the same place and follow this same progression. Right view also arises from the one who knows, this faculty of awareness. When it is correct, then the incorrect will vanish. When it is right, that which is wrong will vanish. Thus, when the Buddha was developing the perfections of the Bodhisattva, performing great austerities and living on minute amounts of food to the point where his body became severely emaciated, some insight was born within him. He realized that all the Buddhas of the past were enlightened through the mind, not through the body. The body by itself doesn't know anything. Feeding it or not feeding it is not the point. Others can even kill this body without harming the mind. So after he had this change of outlook, after he attained enlightenment and began to teach, he pointed out that the enlightenment of all the Buddhas was attained through cultivation of mind. When he looked deeply within his own mind, he gave up practicing the extremes of sensual indulgence and self-mortification, and he pointed this out clearly in his first teaching. His first sermon cut directly through the misconceptions and mistaken practices of ordinary beings. Being immersed in the pursuit of pleasure, comfort, and happiness, in the pride that seeks to elevate and extol oneself, is not the path that one who has gone forth from the world should walk. The state of dissatisfaction and suffering, of negativity, aversion, and anger, is self-mortification. It brings about no benefit at all. These two paths are not the way a seeker of liberation should walk. They refer to the extremes of elation and depression, indulgence and suppression. The one who walks the path is our own awareness, which should not follow these extreme reactions of mind. The mind should not be left to follow what it supposes to be good or bad, because that becomes the cause of joy or sorrow. If it becomes happy over something, there is then attachment to what is perceived as good, and that is the extreme of indulgence. If there is something that is perceived as being bad, that is grasped with aversion, invested with negative significance. This is the mind following the two extremes, pleasure on one side, pain on the other, which the Buddha summarized as sensual indulgence and self-mortification. These two paths are not the way of a samana, a tranquil being. They are the ways of worldly people. All worldly beings are constantly in search of happiness and pleasure. They are habituated to the extreme reactions of attraction and aversion to things and are always being bounced back and forth between the two as they undergo ceaseless change and keep on trading places. This is the way of the world. If there is happiness, there will be suffering. There is suffering, and then there is happiness, and then there is suffering again. These are things that will always be uncertain and unstable. Thus they are the Dhamma of those who are mired in the world, those who are not at peace. Those who are at peace do not go this way, but they do see and know about these things. They see pleasure and happiness, but not accepting them as real. They don't get attached to or stuck in them. They are aware of whatever aversion there may be to things, but they do not take that as a path either. These are people who see the path. Those who are tranquil understand the way that is not tranquil while still remaining at peace. The way of seeking happiness with its resultant depression and elation over things is recognized as a mistaken path. The wise also experience such phenomena but do not expect to find any ultimate meaning in them, so they let go of such reactions. The ones who are at peace are unshaken by these things, by happiness and suffering. When there is no more meaning seen in things, one naturally lets go of happiness and suffering in accord with their nature. When happiness and suffering are known for what they are, they become invalid phenomena. They have no meaning in the mind of the awakened being. There is mere recognition of them, that happiness or suffering are appearing, like hot or cold appearing. It is not that there is no recognition or awareness. So it is said that the arahant is one far from the mental afflictions. Actually, he or she does not go anywhere far away. They don't flee from the afflictions, and the afflictions do not flee from them. It's like a lotus leaf in the water. The lotus leaf exists in the water and lives nourished by the water. The water is in contact with the lotus, but cannot penetrate or submerge it. The afflictions are the water. The mind of the practitioner is the lotus leaf. They contact each other. The lotus doesn't need to avoid the water, but they remain separate. The mind of the yogin is like this. It does not flee or escape to anywhere. When good comes, it is aware. When bad comes, it is aware. When there is happiness or suffering, like or dislike, the mind is aware. It is aware of everything that occurs, but it merely recognizes these states. They cannot penetrate the mind. This means there is no grasping and no attachment to things. In Dhamma language, it is spoken of as equanimity, keeping the mind balanced and neutral. In ordinary speech, we call it recognition, being informed or notified of what is going on. There is no involvement or taking sides. Just as when we meet someone and he tells us about something, we merely take note of what he has to say. We don't necessarily believe anything, we merely take note. This kind of attitude must be maintained continuously because these things exist in this world. The Buddha was enlightened in the world. He taught in the world. He examined the facts of the world. If he had not examined and come to understand the world, when he met with the world, he would not have been able to transcend it. After his enlightenment, the world was still there as before. For example, there was still praise. There was still criticism. There was still material gain, rank, happiness, and suffering. If none of these things existed, there would be no basis for enlightenment, because they are the very opposite of enlightenment. When the Buddha was enlightened, he awakened to the truth of these worldly dhammas that deceive and obscure the minds of human beings. Gain and loss, rank and disrepute, happiness and suffering, praise and blame belong to the world. If the minds of people follow after these things and fall under their sway, that is called worldliness. These eight dhammas destroy the eightfold path. Whenever they increase, the path vanishes. When they occupy and fill the heart, there will be no opportunity for walking the path that makes an end of suffering. There is only the world flooding the heart and keeping it in a state of turmoil, anxiety, and distress. Thus we are taught to develop the path, which is wisdom. The path can be summarized as developing morality to the utmost, developing samadhi to the utmost, and developing wisdom to the utmost. These are the tools and faculties for destroying the fiction that is called the world, the path for destroying the worldliness dwelling in the hearts of deluded beings. Whenever attachment to happiness and suffering, to gain and loss, is present in the mind, the world is there. The mind is the world. A worldly being has been born of craving. If craving is extinguished, the world is extinguished, because this blind craving is the source of the world. The Eightfold Path and the eight worldly dhammas are a pair. These two ways exist in the same place. It's not as if they're in separate realms. The attachment to happiness, status, praise, and gain exists in the mind with the one who knows. But when there is attachment, the one who knows is obscured, so its knowledge is mistaken, and it is dwelling in the world. The world comes to be in the mind. The one who knows has not yet awakened the Buddha nature, so it cannot remove itself from worldliness. When we train the body, speech, and mind in morality, meditation, and wisdom, we soon come to see the worldly dhammas buried in the heart. We will see ourselves clinging to them and how that clinging comes about. If we train and make the mind able, we will thus see the world and its origins. The Buddha said, O bhikkhus, look upon this world as an ornamented and bejeweled royal chariot, by which fools are dazzled and entranced, but which is meaningless to the wise. To see the world, we don't have to go traveling all over Thailand and other countries. We need only look at this mind immersed in worldliness. Then sitting under a tree, we can see the world. When we determine to practice and develop the path, we try to practice samadhi, to focus and pacify the mind. But the mind does not become focused and peaceful so easily. We don't want it to think, but it keeps on thinking. Really, the mind of an ordinary person is like someone sitting on a nest of red ants. Sitting so close to them, they're going to bite. When we who have the worldly dhammas filling our hearts start to practice with our worldly minds, the habits of attraction and aversion, elation and depression, distraction and worry all immediately start to surface. This is quite a natural occurrence for those who have not yet attained the dhamma and whose minds are filled with worldliness. We have not yet seen through these habits and are thus not able to resist their power. So it's just like sitting on an anthill. We're sitting right on their home, so of course they will come up and bite us. When they're biting, what should we do? We have to find some way to destroy them. put down poison, cover them with earth, or set fire to the nest so they will flee. This is what practice entails, making an effort to combat what torments us. But practitioners don't generally think like this. Whenever they are feeling good about something, they go along with it. If something makes them unhappy, they are affected by that. When they meet with praise and blame and the rest, they react according to habit and pursue them, never quelling them. When that happens, there is the world. People who study a little bit will look at this and say they just can't do it. It's too hard to let go of these things. That only means they're afraid to exert the effort. When the mental afflictions occur, the eight worldly dhammas suppress and obscure the eightfold path. People can't endure things, so they cannot maintain morality, and they can't persevere in meditating to calm the mind. They can't control themselves and endure in order to contemplate the workings of the mind. It's just like the guy sitting on the anthill. He's out of his mind with pain and discomfort from the bites, so there is nothing he is able to focus on or accomplish. Unable to remove the source of his misery, he just remains there, trying to endure somehow. This is how it is. The worldly dhammas and the Buddhist path of practice are always going to be antagonistic to each other. When ordinary people try to train the mind and make it tranquil, things that have been residing there will come gushing out. If delusion is allowed to remain in control, the mind is in darkness. But when knowledge is born through perseverance, delusion dissipates and the mind is illumined. Knowledge and delusion occur in the same place. When knowledge is born, delusion cannot stay. When worldliness rules and we cannot find the Eightfold Path, we have to make efforts to practice tranquility and insight meditation. It's necessary to keep at it until we can see the attachment, aversion, and confusion that come from contact with the eight worldly dhammas starting to decrease. When they become lighter, we are able to recognize them more clearly and start to remove ourselves from the world, which resides within us as these things and our grasping reactions to them. One who practices should bear witness as to how much progress is being made on this path. There are only two choices, right view and wrong view, and everything follows from them. The practitioner becomes like two people, meaning the way of the world and the way of Dhamma, struggle within the mind. The development of the path will gradually and steadily harass and kill off the worldly dhammas, until in the end the wisdom of right view arises and wrong understanding vanishes. The final result is that the path destroys the afflictions. The two ways continuously contend with each other all throughout our efforts to practice, and this can continue even when we think we are gaining insight through vipassana, meditation. It can easily turn into vipassanupakilesa, the defilement of insight. What does this mean? When we develop the path, we make efforts to practice virtue and purify the mind. But whatever good results we get, we can become elated over them and attached to them. This elation is just another form of grasping and becomes vipassanupakilesa, the wisdom of the mental afflictions. Some people will develop a little goodness and then become attached to that goodness. When they attain some sort of purity, they become attached to purity. When they attain knowledge, they become attached to knowledge. This clinging to knowledge and purity is vipassanu infecting the practice. So when practicing vipassana and gaining some insight, beware of vipassanu, because they can be very similar and you can be misled, unaware of what is taking place. The vital point is that when vipassanu occurs, there will eventually be some suffering as its fruit. If it is truly vipassana, there is no suffering. It is genuinely peaceful, purified of happiness and suffering. Practice really has to depend on steadfastness and patient endurance. Some people start to practice meditation, and they have ideas and desires as to how they want it to be. They expect the mind to be calm right away, but the old seeds and habits of turmoil are there, so the practitioners will have to experience their ripening. It's important to make efforts where this distress appears. We might feel we would be fine without such disciplines that cause us to feel bothered and oppressed. We could eat and sleep in comfort and at will. We could talk about whatever we like when we have the urge. We could go here and there as we wish, and following our impulses like this would bring well-being. The teaching of the Buddha talks about resisting, grating against things. The way of transcendence grates against the worldly. Right view grates against wrong view. Purity grates against impurity. These things are always going to be incompatible. In the scriptures, there's a fable to illustrate this. Before the Buddha attained enlightenment, when he had accepted and eaten rice porridge from the milkmaid, Sujata, he set the dish on the surface of a southerly flowing river and made the aspiration. If I am going to become a supremely awakened Buddha, may this dish flow north. The dish flowed to the north. The dish symbolized his right view, the inherent Buddhahood of the mind's basic awareness that does not follow the inclinations of ordinary beings. At that moment, it was able to go against the current of all worldliness in his heart and not be influenced by anything. So now we have his teachings, which go against the flow of our habits. We have impulses of desire and attraction, but he tells us not to crave. We have the impulse to be angry and displeased over things, but he tells us not to be averse. We tend to be deluded about things, and he shows us how to destroy delusion. This teaching is always aimed at uprooting these habits. The Buddha's mind was going entirely against the currents of the world, the things that are normally said to be attractive and beautiful. He did not see as attractive and beautiful. The world said that the body belongs to oneself, but he did not see it as his own. These things are said to be meaningful. The things that are said to be meaningful and valuable, he did not see as meaningful and valuable. His view is beyond the way of worldly beings, which merely clings to phenomena. This state of awareness arose in him. Following that, there is the legend of his receiving 8 handfuls of grass from a Brahmin. He made a seat from it and vowed to attain enlightenment there. If the inner meaning of this is explained, the 8 handfuls of grass are the 8 worldly dhammas. His efforts were to destroy them. This is what a practitioner must do. Destroy attachment to gain, status, praise, pleasure, and their opposites. The grass was offered to him, and he vowed to sit on it and enter meditative absorption. Sitting on it is a metaphor for suppressing the worldly dhammas. His mind was above them, bent on attaining the transcendent dhamma. The transcendent is that which renders the worldly meaningless, like refuse. To him, gain and the rest were just refuse. He could sit on them, but they did not affect or obstruct him at all. Sitting in that place, many experiences arose in the mind of the teacher until he was able to reach enlightenment and conquer Mara, the evil one. He conquered the world, nothing else. He taught to develop the path which can destroy the worldly dhammas, just as the grass was made into his throne of enlightenment. These days, most of us practitioners have little faith in devotion. We come to practice for a year or two and are full of desire for rapid attainment. We don't think about the Buddha, how he developed the perfections in order to become the supreme teacher. After leaving home, he exerted himself to the utmost for 6 years. Practicing well, really training the mind and developing our qualities, we can gain experience, and then we can appreciate the virtues of the Buddha. At the very least, we should realize the first level of awakening. It's not just a matter of counting the months and years spent in practice. The mind should attain something. We will have modesty, a sense of shame, and fear toward wrong actions. This is extremely important. We who train properly will not dare to do wrong, whether it is in front of others or behind their sight, in the light or in the dark, because we have approached the Buddha, meaning we have given rise to the one who knows within ourselves. We rely on the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha as our refuge. If we truly rely on the Buddha for refuge, we must come to see the Buddha. We must see the Dhamma and the Sangha. We recite the formula of refuge in the 3 jewels, but still we don't really know the Buddha. Are we close to him? Are we far from him? What is the Dhamma? What is the Sangha? We request their protection as our refuge, but are we close to them yet? Do we know what they are? We request with body and speech, but our minds have not reached there. Once the mind attains and is able, we will know exactly what the qualities of the 3 jewels are. We will know the Buddha has such and such characteristics, the Dhamma is such, and so on. This will be our experience. We will have this refuge because these things have arisen in our minds. Then, wherever we may be, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha are there with us. Thus, we will not perform wrong actions. So the first Arya, Kondanya, was freed from falling into the lower realms. This was something definite. He could only follow the straight path, and there would be no eighth rebirth, because the path had been shown and he had attained certainty. Sooner or later, he was bound to reach the end of the path. There was no way he could ever return to performing wrong actions by way of body or speech. He had gone beyond the sort of turmoil that is actually hell itself. So it is said that the Arya is freed from the lower realms. Even if he or she is mistaken about something, it is nothing strong enough to throw him or her into a lower rebirth. The mind cannot go that way anymore. It cannot return to its old ways. This is called the Aryan birth, and it can happen in this life. These are things that can only be known by the individual through direct experience. We all talk about Dhamma and are supposedly practicing Dhamma, but we don't really know what Dhamma is. Understanding Dhamma, seeing Dhamma, practicing Dhamma, what is it all about? This is really a problem for us. It is nature. The ordinary that is already present, things existing as they are. Why are we now under the sway of happiness and suffering, gladness and dejection? Because we don't know Dhamma. We do not see Dhamma. The Buddha intended for us to be free of attachment to the five aggregates, to lay them down and give up involvement with them. We cannot give them up, however, because we don't really know them for what they are. We believe happiness to be ourselves. We see ourselves as happy. We believe suffering to be ourselves and see ourselves as unhappy. We can't pull the mind out of this view, which means we are not seeing nature. There isn't any self involved, but we are always thinking in terms of self. Thus it seems that happiness happens to us, suffering happens to us, elation happens to us, depression happens to us. The chain of self is constructed, and with this solid feeling that there is a self, everything seems to be happening to us. So the Buddha said to destroy this conception, this block called self. When the concept of self is destroyed and finished, we are free of the belief that there is a self in the body, and then the condition of selflessness is naturally revealed. Believing there is me and mine and living with selfishness, everything is understood as being a self or belonging to a self or somehow relating to a self. When the phenomena of nature are seen thus, there's no real understanding. If nature appears to be good, we laugh and rejoice over it. If phenomena appear to be bad, we cry and lament. Thinking of natural phenomena as constituting ourselves or something we own, we create a great burden of suffering to carry. If we realized the truth of things, we would not have all the drama of excitement, elation, grief, and tears. It is said, pacification is true happiness. And this comes when attachment is rooted out through seeing reality. Reality exists in the phenomena of nature, in their appearing, changing, and disappearing. That is their truth. It is people who are not true. We become excited by things, but phenomena are not excited in themselves. We become attached to things, wanting them to be a certain way, taking them to be ours. We react with extreme emotions depending on whether they seem to turn out in the right way or the wrong way, meaning whether they turn out according to our desires. Thus, Anya Kondanya saw the nature of all things. His view was transformed in the moment when he first heard the teachings of the Buddha. He saw clearly and truly. From that moment on, whatever he encountered, he just saw arising and passing away. Pleasant and unpleasant phenomena still kept appearing to his mind, but he merely recognized their appearance. There was no way he could again fall into the states of extreme suffering that are called the lower realms. His mind firmly established in awareness, he could no longer react to things with gladness or dejection. So it is said that Kondanya received the eye of Dhamma that sees according to reality. Wisdom knowing the truth of all existence was born in him. This is one who knows and sees Dhamma. When one knows, one renounces and lets go of things, lays down the burden. We try to bear giving things up, employing forced endurance and renunciation. but we don't see Dhamma through this. When one really attains and sees, there is nothing to be endured or given up. When one sees Dhamma, there is only Dhamma. And in Dhamma, there is no enduring or renouncing. But when we don't yet know and realize Dhamma, when it is not our being, we have to apply the conventions of Dhamma, exerting ourselves in various practices. We have to apply effort because of the tendency to laziness. We employ endurance and forbearance because of a lack of determination and an inability to bear things and restrain ourselves. But if one has practiced well and is habituated to it, no kind of forced effort is needed.
Well, can I ask a question on the worldly wings? They all seem quite distinct, but status and praise seem very closely related. Why?
I think it's one is more like one's like position. Praise is more like, you know, just that sense of, you know, being given praise for something or being criticized for something, whereas status is sort of one's position, having some kind of position, status having some kind of a, the word in Thai is yot, and it's like if you've got some kind of a title or a, you know, some kind of, well, say being an abbot, or having some sort of position, or, you know, even being a monk, say, and then holding to that, and then being either, you know, puffed up because of that, or being threatened for some reason or other, if that's being taken away from one, or it changes, so that it's more like a status within the eyes of other people. And yeah, status is maybe a good word, sort of status or lack of status. And then praise and blame are more about the, some kind of criticism or some kind of lifting up in some other way. The actual. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't think I grasp it fully, but it makes more sense.
Okay. Yes. I would have been curious about why a Sotapanna can't be reborn one seven times. Why number seven?
Wasn't seven a lucky number? I have no idea. I don't think it's a commentarial thing. I think it's scriptural. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure that it's something that the Buddha himself said at some point. And I think it's just sort of, and it may be arbitrary in a sense of that's the longest that somebody with who has the eye of Dhamma has arisen, and even if one just kind of coasted after that, you know, the longest one would take would be seven lifetimes. And oftentimes what happens is that's, of course, it's a stimulant to further investigation and practice and further deepening of insight, which then changes the ball game after. Yes?
I find it interesting that he equates the extreme of self-mortification to aversion, ill will, kind of condition of the mind to push away or to not like things.
Yeah, and that's quite typical to Ajahn Chah, where his that because it, because I think it, he in many ways his teaching, you know, he really tried to bring it back to something that we're experiencing, and oftentimes the, especially when it's explained in the suttas. You know, sort of the attakilamatana yoko is then, you know, explained in terms of, you know, laying on brambles and fasting, and it sort of Ajahn Chah really tried to bring it internally and you know, well, what is it that creates suffering? It's not really a you know, that tendency to swing between, yeah, desire and aversion. I found it really helpful that he kept emphasizing that rather than the say external application of a standard, that it's those, because that's really the root of where we end up getting caught and creating that swinging of the mind. Which doesn't mean we don't, and I think Ajahn Chah expressed that really well it isn't as if there isn't kind of a movement toward or a recognition, oh, I don't like that. But it's seeing that the mind doesn't invest in it. And so therefore it doesn't build the momentum of, and and that's actually a teaching that Ajahn Liam would emphasize a lot. There's the moods of the mind that have the tendency to, you know, liking or to not liking, but it doesn't go into full blown kind of. Anger, aversion, or into full-blown kind of gratification or grasping, so that it isn't as if the mind, you know, doesn't have anything, but it's one sees it and seeing it as a mood, then it can be relinquished. And it's also where, and Ajahn Chah mentions it in this talk, where the literal translation for the word arahant, and it comes across in the Thai, and I don't know how it's translated so easily into English. But the arahant is one who is far from defilement. So that it isn't as if the mind still doesn't have tendencies, but it's far from it. So it doesn't. They're seen and understood as they arise, so then they don't overwhelm the mind or they don't affect the mind. And I think that's an important distinction, because sometimes we try to create some kind of ideal purity or some kind of ideal state of being, which isn't so necessary. It's that seeing the worldly and what leads to the movement of the mind, and then that, and in that quality of knowing, it can be resolved and relinquished. It's something that I found really empowering, actually.
So would this quality of knowing be maybe a variation of the teaching of Sati Sampajanya?
Constant
investigation ones.
Yeah, and that's that application of mindfulness, clear comprehension, in the Thai language, when they talk about it, they often talk about satipanya, sort of mindfulness and wisdom. So there's that mindfulness and wisdom functioning together.
Like hearing you said about the arahant being far from defilements, because I've always heard that phrase like Mara, I see you.
Right.
You know, is this like, you know, defilements, or, you know, yeah, something's coming up. But I mentioned that to some monks, and I get really negative, like, no, you would never experience it.
Buddha never experienced that. You know, that's you know, it's a, you know, there's been debates going on for 2,500 years, so we're not going to resolve it. But you know, certainly in terms of certainly how Ajahn Chah and many of the forest teachers practice, and then reflecting on some of the the circumstances, even in the suttas, where obviously the Buddha has memories of being in the world, and different impressions are there, and it's you don't just get the whole sort of slate wiped clean, and there's nothing there anymore. It's sort of the mind is not pulled by it or weighed down by it, and then I think it's that, and again it's that insight into the self, and the construction of self that is the freeing insight. And it's also, you think of that, of the Sotapanna, the first insight that is, or the first aspect that is penetrated and dropped for a stream enterer is the Sakkaya Ditti, that sense of taking one or other of the five khandhas, of aspects of body and mind, of this is self, there's self there, there's self in this, there's self, there's all of the permutations, but it's that investment of self, of I, of me, of mine, in that, and that is, that can be relinquished, because one sees that one's fundamentally torturing oneself with it.
Isn't the sutta where the Buddha says the amazing thing about the Bodhisattva? Uh-huh. And you know when a thought arises in the Bodhisattva, he knows it's a thought.
Right,
the Bodhisattva doesn't have thought.
Yeah, that's a good one, because it also comes on the end of the recitation of all these incredibly miraculous things, and then the Buddha just sort of saying, yeah, and then another really amazing and miraculous thing is that, you know, the Tathagata knows a thought when it arises, knows when it's established, knows when it ceases. That's a miracle. Okay.